And I have found immense value in just being brutally honest with my investors about what I'm excited about and what I'm not. Transparency and truth, it's the right thing to do, but it's also, I think it takes a lot of stress off of you as an entrepreneur.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the Rudman Institute at UCSF, the University of California in San Francisco. Today, we have Ryan Pierce, who has an extensive background in innovation. He is a lecturer in bioengineering at Stanford University and co-founder and CEO of Nine, a neonatal maternal health technology company. He has served as vice president of design and innovation at Ventus Medical, vice president of business development at Loma Vista Medical, a healthcare investor at DeNova Ventures, and a product designer at Concentric Medical and the foundry Zever Medical. In this talk, recorded live at UCSF Mission Bay on December 11, 2018, Ryan gave entrepreneurs a comprehensive introduction to getting funded. He covers topics such as self-funding, convertible note, equity round, deal terms, and how to close a round. It is the full picture. Enjoy the talk. And if you'd like to see his slide deck, please go to rosamondinstitute.org. It's under the podcast.
Thank you, Christine, and thank you to the Rosamond Institute, and thank you to everyone who came tonight. This is my first time wearing a head mic, so bear with me if it throws me off my game a bit. Prior to founding a company, I had worked for four different medical device companies and two VC firms. Most of the medtech companies were very early stage, and the VCs ranged from a larger fund that managed hundreds of millions invested in medical devices to a firm focused on digital health with a much smaller amount of capital to deploy. And so through those experiences, I sat on both sides of the table. I was pitching to potential investors, and I was the potential investor. And felt like going into starting my own company, like I kind of knew how that early stage of creating an organization worked. Nevertheless, I was surprised on many levels, but one of them was how many decisions had to be made in those early days of fundraising. When should we raise money? How much should we raise? What deal term should we use? How hard do I sell? Who do I pitch first? Who do I pitch last? What goes in the deck? What's our minimum investment? Is it a safe, a convertible note, a priced round? There were no obvious answers, at least for me, as I made those decisions at the same time I'm trying to actually get work done. So what we're going to talk about tonight are some templates that I either came up with or wish I'd come up with have come out of some of the best practices that I've witnessed as an investor, with the hopes that it helps some of you navigate those decisions that you'll have to make in the 30 days before you start fundraising so that you can start off on the right foot with your investors so you can fundraise successfully and get back to the important work of making medical devices that will help people. So it's worth considering, I think, before we even look at any of those decisions or any of those questions, the big question of why do startups exist? If a large cap company exists to capitalize on mitigated risks, startups exist to mitigate that risk in the first place. In med tech, that's IP risk, financing risk, safety risk, reimbursement risk. We have all of our own flavors of risk. And on the first day, you may have seven or eight of those with very little indication of whether you can do it at all. And the hope is that by the time you're done fundraising and that you've been acquired or you've become a public company or you've become a sustainable company, most of those risks have been mitigated. But how do you map that on to fundraising? And one thing I did early on is sat down at a coffee shop with a blank piece of paper. I like to graph things, so create a y-axis labeled risk mitigated and an x-axis labeled dollars, another one labeled months. And went through and said, how many dollars do I need to mitigate the most risk possible? What you kind of end up with is this staircase-shaped graph where you've, for example, figured out that you can get an issued patent, or you've figured out that that technical challenge that you weren't sure you could solve is actually solvable. And ask yourself, what's the cost to get there in dollars or months? So those of you who are listening to this talk but are not in the room, don't see this, but basically I have this y-axis with risk mitigated and x-axis with dollars or months and different lines for different companies. So you can imagine a company in the medical robotics space that may not be able to mitigate serious risk without raising tens of millions of dollars. So if you're someone who has a comparative advantage of raising tens of millions of dollars, that may be a great space to be in. If you don't think you're a particularly good fundraiser, or if you think you're a really good chemical engineer who can solve chemical problems cheaply and quickly, you might want to be thinking about a different company that has a different shaped staircase on that graph. But for me, it was a really helpful exercise to go through and say, for what I'm trying to do, how can I move north on that graph as quickly as possible before moving to the right on that graph? I'll give you a quick anecdote. I worked on sleep apnea devices for a company called Ventus. And in the early days, we had very modest funding. I think we had $1 million. And we wanted to get through a clinical trial on that. And we stepped back and said, well, what can we show on $1 million? How can we mitigate risk? And our product, in a nutshell, was a sticker that goes across the nostrils that when you breathe through it, creates a pressure effect somewhat similar to a CPAP machine. And this is the first example. So this is tubing that would connect to a system to measure the pressure. You can't see it here, but this is a injection molded piece of plastic. Some foam that, as I recall, came from a hospital bed manufacturer. They sent me a sample that was the size of a hospital bed. And I called them up and said, can you send me certs on that so we can put it into the quality system? And they did. And that was about 99 times as much as we needed to build all of our clinical trial devices. It's fastened together using sutures, somewhat unnecessarily, except the nice thing about sutures is that you know they're biocompatible. So we took away that risk. So this device, we put into a clinical trial to get our first regulatory clearance. And as you can see, it's hideous in appearance. But we didn't think that we really had aesthetic risk in the long term. We had safety risk. We had clinical risk. We were able to mitigate that very quickly. So as you're thinking about fundraising, I think it's useful to say, where's that efficient frontier? Where are those local maxima of risk reduction versus cost? And if nothing else, that limits your possibilities to how much money you should raise, because you kind of say, well, there are these three or four options. Maybe I try a leapfrog in a single funding round, pass a couple of these dots, or maybe I just go for here and then maybe get a higher valuation. But it bounds the problem a bit to focus on those local maxima along the way. The other thing it will do is it will point you to a category of funding sources. So we're going to talk some about what you might do before you even go raise an angel round. We'll call that self-funded. Or do you just go ahead to a VC and skip over the angel round? But it kind of fits these orders of magnitude. What can I get done on tens of thousands of dollars, which probably isn't worth doing an angel round for? What can I do on hundreds of thousands, which isn't quite into the domain of a venture capitalist? If you're getting past the million point, there's probably a no man's land in there where it's a little bit too much to be doing an angel round, a little bit below a VC. So hopefully you have some risk mitigation points in that range. But you can kind of think of these orders of magnitude and let them point you to who you should be talking to. So I want to talk a little bit about this option of self-funding. In other words, should you raise money at all? And I think this is especially relevant to people who are coming out of school. I was talking to an entrepreneur recently who had just graduated, had a pretty neat idea that I think may have come out of a class project. So two or three other students involved, not really clear who's going to be involved in the long term or not. And he decided to go take a full-time job for a med tech company. And if you think about that, it's a pretty good situation. I don't know what an entry-level engineer makes these days. But let's say, you know, 100,000, 110, 125, depending on where you are, you can probably live on less than that. So a model that worked for him was to make more than he needed and use that excess capital to go create a lot of value and mitigate a lot of risk very easily, or very quickly, I won't say easily, very cost efficiently. And in the meantime, you know, what I'll call his existence costs, food and shelter and health insurance are conveniently being covered by his employer. So, you know, there are a lot of advantages to this. I think this is kind of unheralded, but there's a place for this in your life cycle or in your mitigation of risk cycle. It's going to force you to be really frugal because you don't have much money to waste.
There's a good chance that's where you're going to meet your future colleagues, your future investors. I'll talk a little bit later about where mine ended up coming from. It turns out a lot of them were former colleagues. Startups have a lot of headaches. It's kind of lonely sometimes doing a startup. So you get the social part, you get the nice holiday party at your employer, and then you go back and work in the garage. And I think you get a lot of bang for your buck. I know, at least for me, spending 40 hours a week, 30 hours a week, 60 hours a week ideating, there are days you just don't, you're not feeling the inspiration. And there may be something to having smaller chunks of that. And in the meantime, working for the big company and essentially funding what you're about to go build once you have the idea. And obviously, you're going to learn a lot, especially early in your career, learn what a quality system is. And I may have said this before, but being able to go to your investors later and say, hey, I only spent $30,000 on this and look what I've built, because 98% of those funds went directly to risk mitigation, not to paying the state of California an incorporation fee or any of those other existence costs that do really nothing to mitigate risk. So how much do we raise? There are a bunch of heuristics, or I wouldn't even call them that, just sayings, you know, raise as much as you can, as early as you can, blah, blah, blah. But that's not a real, it's not really useful. If someone asks you how much you're raising, you don't say, oh, just as much as I can. It's really hard at the early stages of a company to budget. And part of it is that you're doing a lot of inventing at an early stage. And you're not sure if you're going to have the idea tomorrow, if it's going to take you 6 months. You don't know if your first proof of concept study is going to go well. There's just a lot of noise around it. And the only sure thing about an exact budget for that process is that it's probably going to be wrong. So there are two hacks that at least have been useful for me. One, and this is when I'm putting together a budget to show someone to justify a number. One is to think about, well, what would a not-so-lean company spend to do this? You know, go back to that company that wasn't so lean that you worked for. How much did they spend in the year that they got to that milestone? And use their not-so-leanness as your safety factor. You know you're not going to buy the really nice couch for the lobby and spend a lot of other money on non-risk mitigating expenses, but you can still put it into a budget that looks somewhat reasonable. And if nothing else, you can kind of get into a category, I guess it's my second hack, where you say, well, for example, we're going to be in ballpark of 600,000. And maybe what I'll do is I'll go raise from the category that 600K would point me to, which would be angel financing, and just raise at the top end of that category. So it kind of goes to that logic or that rule of thumb of raising as much as you can, but doing it within the boundaries of a category that's at least guided by the milestone you're trying to reach. So another question is, which is, what do I owe my angel investors? And this is the only slide I have devoted to this, but this turned out to be really important for me to think through. Part of it is I'm not naturally very salesy. I feel pretty uncomfortable doing it. I'm probably not especially good at it. And going to ask people for money, especially amounts of money that often to me just sound like ridiculously huge, I'm not very comfortable doing that. So it was helpful for me to set out what is it that I owe them? What is it that, what are my responsibilities to the person I'm trying to convince to fork over tens of thousands of dollars? Number one is transparency and truth. And you'd think this would be obvious, but if you look at the way that many startups describe themselves, if you see investor updates that sometimes come across the wire or have come across the wire at the VC firms I've worked at, there's a lot of hyperbole. There's a lot of emphasis on what's going well and not much emphasis on what's not going well. And I have found immense value in just being brutally honest with my investors about what I'm excited about and what I'm not. And it makes the conversations when I see them in person much easier. It makes the highs feel much more legitimate because they're real. It's not just the realization of what I pretended was the case already. So transparency and truth, it's the right thing to do, but it's also, I think it takes a lot of stress off of you as an entrepreneur. I think you owe it to them to understand what they invested for. Some of them want a financial return, and you need to intend to deliver that. Again, it sounds obvious, but when you see startups where the founder does well and angel investors don't, that suggests that deal terms weren't designed with that constraint in mind. You'll have other investors who are there for the impact. And if you're telling a big impact story, big impact needs to be part of what you plan to do. You have other investors who have been encouraging you to start a company for many years, and they want to see you take something to the finish line. If it's not your intent to do that, don't tell them that you're going to do that. So part of that goes back to transparency, but taking the time to understand why they are investing. And that especially goes for philanthropies, participants in your funding round that may not be traditional angels. I mentioned fair and well-designed deal terms, which we're going to talk more about. Again, it should be pretty elementary, but if the company succeeds, their investment goal should be met. And that can be a product of the principles with which you manage the company, but also the way you design those deal terms. And finally, to only accept an investment they can afford to lose. And so I think on a practical level, I kept asking myself this question. If someone says they want to put in 25K, am I supposed to say, oh, why isn't it 50 and talk them up to 50? I'm not going to say that that's wrong, but for me, I made the personal decision that the number that they say is probably the number that makes the most sense for them. And there may be other points of view, especially if you're struggling to raise the round, but if it was their idea to put in 25K, then that's probably the number that's best for them.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com.
So let's talk about the mechanics of structuring a seed round. How many of you have raised the seed round before? Okay, quite a few. Show of hands, who did an equity round for that? Okay, a few. And how many did a convertible note or a safe? Okay, a few more, but pretty split. So what I'm going to do on this, I'm going to err on the side of just giving you my opinion and not hedging too much, and telling you what I think is. I'm going to tell you what I think is the right thing to do. And the three questions we're pondering here are equity round versus convertible note or safe. Which deal terms were the element of that? And you can tell I'm going to push us toward the convertible note since those are the kinds of terms I have on the screen. Valuation cap, interest rate, discount, liquidation preference, trigger amount, and the percentage needed to call for repayment. Then finally, do you do a rolling close or a coordinated close? In other words, can you cash checks as they come in, or do you need to make sure you've got all the checks for your round before you declare it done? So equity round versus convertible note and safe. So the spirit of these is that an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist are more likely to arrive at an appropriate valuation than the entrepreneur and their college roommate who may know nothing about startups. And it's a pretty elegant idea. It sort of postpones the hard part, which is what's the valuation, what are the terms, and lets a professional, in essence, represent them. It also gives you some time. You have more information a year later, 2 years later, when you raise that round than you did back when it was kind of an idea in a pitch deck. So I'll just say, my proposition is that the convertible note or a safe, which are kind of cousins of each other, will usually make the most sense for your seed stage round. That doesn't answer the question, though, what are those deal terms? And so I'm just going to go through some quick definitions. So convertible notes, kind of the Google level explanation of the difference is that convertible notes tend to have an interest rate. They're viewed more as debt. We're safe through legal machinations I don't fully understand. Is not technically debt. But again, cousins of each other. So convertible notes, they'll have a valuation cap. And so the idea there is that your angel investors will not have invested at an effective valuation above that cap. An interest rate where they give you $100, how much is that after a year? That's pretty straightforward, but that's the amount that then converts into equity for them. The discount, so you know, it's like a 20% off. That's compared to whatever share price that the institutional investors later do. The terms of no qualifying financing. So what happens if you get acquired before that transition occurs to the equity round? So often that's a guaranteed multiple on their investment or sometimes a guaranteed interest rate on it. The trigger amount. So how big does that subsequent financing have to be to cause a conversion to stock for their funds? And the percentage needed to call for repayment. So the idea there is that if you're not executing and your shareholders decide, we're going to call the loan back, what percentage weighted by dollar have to decide to do that. So in practice, that doesn't happen a lot, partly because it's a pretty good way to kill a company is to suddenly ask for capital back that they don't have. It's also kind of pointless if they don't have the capital. So I want to, before we go any further, define a term that I'm going to call market arbitrary. So I'm defining that as deal terms that make no less sense than the deal terms that all the other startups are using. Turns out that that's pretty useful. So here's a pretty market arbitrary example. Just to define that a little bit further, the idea is that I don't know how to value this thing. There are 409A valuation firms that I don't know if they're smarter than we are, but they sure seem to be much more complicated, and I can't really read the report. I sure don't know whether this is worth $5 million, $4 million, $6 million, but I called my friend Alex and asked him what he used, and that's a data point. I must be in the ballpark, right? I can always say, well, that's what everyone else is doing. So you can kind of see what might be a pretty market arbitrary example here, which is a valuation cap of $6 million, interest rate of 1%, a discount of 15%, a 2x multiple paid before common shareholders are paid, a triggering happening at a round of $2.5 million, and a percent needed to call for repayment of two-thirds of the obligation holders on the note. So my advice on this, I talked to a lot of especially early entrepreneurs who maybe haven't worked for a medtech company yet or any other startup, and they're looking for, can I get that up to an $8 million or a $7 million? And I think my argument here is that there's something special about that market arbitrary rate. We all know it's arbitrary, but it's like fair arbitrary, if that makes sense. So start there is my advice, and then tweak that, like look at these terms and say, is there anything about that that makes this deal less than a win-win or less along that win-win direction than it can be? Are there any booby traps that are going to come back to haunt us? So let's go through a couple of examples. So in this term sheet, we have a valuation cap. We have no valuation cap. And by the way, these are not crazy. These are not unrepresentative things that we've seen in the venture community. So you have a valuation cap, not applicable, no interest rate, but you have a discount of 20%. 2x multiple before common shareholders are paid, trigger amount of 1 million, percent needed to call for repayment, 75%. And in that round, Uncle Dave invested 250K of the 750K. Anyone see anything that could go wrong? Valuation get pretty high. What's wrong with that? Okay, the investor, and why is it unfair for the investor to have a much lesser share than they thought they would have? Took on a lot of risk. Okay, good. Anything else? We actually see this a lot. To be honest, we see a lot at Rock Health. I don't know why I'm using a hushed tone since this will be on a podcast. But the shtick, if I may say that, is a lot of hype. This is the hot startup. You're privileged to be a part of it as an angel investor. You're lucky to get a 20% discount on whatever the big valuation is that we're about to get from the big name firm. And you've essentially done an angel investment that may be on like a $20 million valuation. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Good catch. So the 75% requirement for repayment means that if Uncle Dave's not in on that, it's not going to happen. So I think we got them both. Example two, valuation cap of $4 million, interest rate of 15%, a million raised, discount percentage none, terms of no qualifying financing before exit, conversion at valuation cap, trigger amount $3.5 million. The company's raised $3 million in non-dilutive financing, and percent needed to call for repayment 66%. See any problems? Good. So they found $3 million in non-dilutive financing, which should be a good thing, right? And so they're able to run on that for a while because they're lean. But as you're saying, 15%, if that compounds, especially if they've taken in a million compared to a 4 million caps, that's a pretty tight ratio. They've given up a lot more of their company in a seed round despite doing a lot of things right, like raising non-dilutive financing and letting that runway take them for a long time into the future. I think we nailed that one too. So we've talked about convertible note versus safe. Talked about deal terms and basically looking for market arbitrary and then making it better if you can. We did not talk about rolling close versus coordinated close. So all else equal, if you're the entrepreneur, you want to get stuff done. So you like the rolling close. The downside to that is if you've raised a third of what you need to get to that first risk mitigation point and you can't raise any more. So that's why you might go for a coordinated close so that you know that you have it. But the way to predict or understand what the risk of that is really a product of when you're thinking about who you're going to pitch, calculating basically your chances of hitting that number. And so what we have on the screen is a fake spreadsheet populated with names of my friends and my cousins. So several columns, name, the best guess of the investment size, the likelihood that they would invest, be the first investor in your company. So that's probably a low case. A likelihood of being the last investor after it's been somewhat de-risked. So it should be a higher number in many cases. Whether there's a value add, they may be a physician, a VC, may have come from a network that's not your own, maybe a patient with a good perspective there, an engineer. And then why are they going to invest? For the returns, for fun, for impact, because they want you to take the leap and become an entrepreneur. There's some redundancy between some of these things, or at least the usefulness of it. The percentages there have baked into them, especially when you see narrow percentages like 50% to be the first dollar or 50% to be the last dollar. Your potential for impact may not change that much if they're not concerned with not especially concerned with getting their money back. But for me, this was a really helpful exercise because I had targeted a certain amount when I raised my round. And it's one thing to kind of say, oh, that sounds like a number that people often raise. But to go through the exercise of saying, well, where's it actually going to come from can be very useful. So what I have at the top here are expected values. So that's just, as you'd expect, the amount times the likelihood. And so what this has produced for this fictional example is expected range somewhere in that 178, if I'm totally doing the sequencing wrong, to 237, 750. So if I was trying to raise a couple hundred thousand dollars, it looks like I'm roughly in the ballpark of where I would want to be. So I highly recommend doing this as that first exercise to say, how much can I really raise? At that point, the next thing to do is to sequence. And so there are different views on how to do this. I'm going to propose the following, which is to start with low likelihood investors who aren't going to get much more likely when you're almost done with the round and aren't going to put in that much money anyway and practice with them. I was surprised, as many pitches as I've seen over the years, I was surprised how much worse I was at it the first few times I did it compared to the last few times I did it. And I've been part of two financing efforts. One was to buy the assets of a company that was going out of business, and one was to start the company that I run now. And that first time, I'll just indict myself for my foolishness and tell you the story. I need a sizable amount of money for that, and I did something like this. I was like, well, okay, I'm going to sort by the amount that, like, my best guess. And I basically was calling, like, the richest people I knew. First of all, I'm not sure why I was cold calling them. Literally caught one of them on the beach, so like he can't really hear me over the waves. It's clear like I was the last person he wanted to talk to in that situation. So being systematic about this, it doesn't mean that you're going to totally stick to the protocol. For my current company, the first check I got was I was out with a friend for drinks, and he'd had a couple cocktails. He's like, I'm in for this much. And I said, well, let's talk in a couple days when you're not under the influence. There's nowhere in the model for that, but I think the main point here is to be systematic about it. At the same time, be thinking about those values that we set forth earlier on what your responsibility is to your investor. I think for me, again, to some degree, this felt very contrived and almost manipulative, like to be thinking about, oh, I'm going to call that person when I've already got this much raised. But that's all the more reason to have those principles set up front so that you're not convincing someone to do something that's against their best interest. So conventional wisdom will say that you should set a pretty meaningful minimum. I often hear 25K, and I get the logic behind that. If you're trying to raise a half million and you're only taking 2,000, it's going to take you a long time. I'll say this, I disagree. Sticking to the idea that I'll let my investors say a number, it doesn't mean I would have taken anything, but my the smallest checks I received were 10,000, and I got several of those. And in many cases, those are investors who have been tremendously value add. They have a network. When they introduce me as someone who might invest in my company and they can say that they're an investor, there's a lot of value to put on that, right? You know, I kind of ran the math on this last night and said, well, if I had a bunch of people who want to put in $10,000 and there's a 50% chance that they'd actually do it, like, is that worth the hour to grab coffee with them? I think you have to have a pretty high opinion of your time to decide that that's not worth it. Okay. And then lastly, diversify by value add, by background, by network. I did this semi-intentionally and probably mostly just got lucky. But my investors include physicians. They include venture capitalists who have invested privately, their own fund. I've got some people who have done well in the tech world, so they have credibility with a funding community that I had no other in with. So be mindful of that. And again, it's impossible to model this, but just having a dashboard in the term of a, in the form of a spreadsheet can be really helpful.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com.
So, the pitch deck. I really think this is pretty simple. We get a lot of pitch decks sent to us at Rock Health. At the end of the day, tell me about you, tell me about the problem, explain your solution, and then tell me your strategy and the capital you need to mitigate risk. Do that cost efficiently, and tell me what progress you've made to date. We see a lot of pitch decks that are trying really hard to push every buzzword possible into the first slide. We're AI-enabled, consumer-facing, drone-delivered, you name it. The fact is, raising money in the startup world is a specialist endeavor. The average company doesn't raise the round at all. The average or the median decision, the mode decision is no. Be something. Be all in on whatever it is you are. That's a necessity to raise money. Slides should assist the conversation, not lead it. This is another thing I noticed as I was doing my pitching. The more I'd done it, the less I used the slides. And not only that, after a while, I felt like they were actually kind of a constraint. And if you think about it, it's kind of weird that you get together with another literate adult, and here's this text in front of both of you that they're reading at their own pace, and then you're reading aloud to them. Just kind of a weird medium. The other one I often see is startups have invested a good chunk of money in like a 60-second highlight video. And so I'm sitting with the entrepreneur in person watching a video of them telling both of us about their company right before they tell me the long version of what we just saw the 60-second version of. I think part of it is you spend a lot of money on it. It's got good graphics. You can feel like you got to use it. But I would encourage you to step back and say, what media and what's the tool that I need to communicate this? So where I end up is after I've done a lot of pitching, the slides that have a bunch of text on them don't get used much. And I basically whittle down to the slides that have pictures of the technology, graphs, things that are much better communicated by a picture than by verbiage. Unfortunately for you all, I've never given this presentation before. So I'm still relying on it to cue me as to what to say. Okay, so I'm at the beginning of that process here. The other thing we see a lot at Rock Health is we get decks that are kind of these one-size-fits-all decks. And so someone will email it in, and there may be like seven slides in a row that are like the unveil of the bullet points. And, you know, it's not the end of the world. Again, our time isn't that valuable that we can't slide through that. But it does signal thoughtfulness, and it signals ability to communicate. And so I would suggest that you need a deck for the coffee shop, and that's likely to be that deck eventually that's mostly going to be sped through to find the graphs and the pictures. You need a deck for formal presentation, where you're making sure everyone in the room can understand what you're describing. And you need a deck that you can email and that makes sense without you there. And then finally, we see a lot of fancy graphics and stuff. I'm going to say that there's a local maximum on investment in graphic design, which is to go to Apple's website and see what font they use. And that's what I did. And get back to work. So this is the last slide. I'll say this. Before I went to pitch a company, as I said earlier, I'm not naturally a real salesy person. I was with a group of Stanford students and I was also with one of the investors in my company, and they asked him, so why did you invest in Ryan? And he goes, Ryan is all substance and no style. I was like, well, definitely not style. And I thought a lot about that. And it goes back to the idea that if you're average along whatever axis, like no one's looking for the average startup to invest in. There is a path to success in fundraising that differs from the hype path. And I think we see that a lot. There's, you know, the pitch competition that kind of rewards the theatrics and the hyperbole. But there's also some reporting bias there, because by definition, those are the approaches that invite and, in a way, beg for a lot of attention. A lot of the most successful entrepreneurs out there never take that path, and you don't hear about it, but I can quickly think of several medtech companies that exited for nine-figure amounts that I don't believe had a website the day they were bought. And so there is a path to success as a company, as a fundraiser, that's less about hype and more about the substance, and there are investors who want that, and almost by definition, you just won't hear as much about them. And then the last point I want to make is that you are your value system. You'll see companies that pivot. So the product changed, the market changed, but the value system is what sticks around. And if I go back and I look at why my investors invested, they were inspired by the technology. They, for better or for worse, liked the way that we're approaching the problem, the way that we're operating it, the way that we're spending money or not spending money. So highlight that. Look for resonance among investors, not just in the size of the market, but the way that you want to run the organization and build a team and fulfill a mission. That's all I have.
I think we'll take questions.
Brian, going back to your comment on this check size, I mean, one of the potential problems of going too small is that you end up having a very long cap sheet and a lot of people to corral. Can you comment a little bit on just sort of maybe is there an optimal number of investors at that sort of angel seed round?
Yeah, I guess some level it's a good problem to have, right? And maybe it's a problem I'll come to regret this one day. I'll say in our case, and I'm glad you asked that question because it reminds me of a point I want to make, which is that all but one of my investors are people I know well. So I do think there's something to, raising money from people whose, their number's in your cell phone already, you see them regularly anyway, that probably mitigates some of that problem of getting the person to return your call. I'm going to riff off that and kind of build on that point and say, I spoke to a lot of potential investors who, were kind of friends of friends or that. And looking back, I think if I was to re-update or redo the probabilities, I would like vastly diminish the probabilities of people I don't know well and vastly increase the probabilities of the people I do. The reason I say that is that you hear a lot of entrepreneurs talk about, we did 97 pitches before we found an investor, and that's a point of pride. It's impressive that they were that gritty and making it happen. It also suggests they're probably talking to the wrong people. There's a very good chance that you know who's going to be your angel investors already, and you should probably optimize your process around getting those people across the line.
You mentioned that you don't have to have media coverage and a sexy story to be a hot startup among venture capitalists. What are some ways that you can be heard of by VCs if you're building, say, in stealth mode? Would you just have to go through a network and do a domino effect, this person's building a great startup? Or
as much as VCs like to say that we'll listen to everyone or anyone, it's the high proportion of investments are made in someone who comes directly from their network or through an introduction from someone that they know well. Yeah. And so I wish I had a less cynical answer.
Yeah.
But I think the best way to get on their radar is to come with the recommendation of someone they trust.
Right. Okay, so how do you get from that one person, like say you found a VC who's pretty high up and he likes what you're doing and you've been in contact with him, but you don't have all of his friends in your network.
You mean like the partnership or?
Just more like other, say you were talking to, I don't know, I'm from the tech world, so I'm going to use tech people.
Sure.
Say you were talking to Sequoia and you knew that that brand name would get you a lot more intros, but you were also building in stealth mode and you didn't really want to honk your horn too high because you've got IP that you're trying to protect at this point in time, but you also want to build the relationships. And so a lot of my VC guy friends tell me that they hear about a startup, the good startups you hear about and the bad startups you have to like come to you begging.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to figure out how I can switch that paradigm for being one of the startups that people hear about instead of approaching people because I'm not from here.
Yeah. So. I don't know if I have a great answer.
Yeah.
Are you working in healthcare?
Yeah, in health.
Okay.
Medical devices.
But I will say this. I think one thing I appreciate about being in healthcare, being a not especially networky person myself, is that it's a pretty small crowd.
Yeah.
So a little networking actually goes a long way because everyone kind of knows each other.
Right.
So I don't know that I would fare well in the tech world. It's just too big and scary and intimidating, all that. But I think in healthcare, I wish I had a more clever answer.
Yeah.
But I think the network, you are already fewer degrees of separation away from those people just by virtue of being in that smaller community.
Hi, I just had a quick question about factoring in things like board seats and like what percentage of investment would require, like what equals one board seat versus multiple, or how do you, is there a way to think through that at all?
It's a good question. I don't know. My data on that is very anecdotal, so almost uselessly anecdotal. I think my approach on that has been to postpone building the board until I'm in a strong enough position to build exactly the board I want. And I'd probably advise that. I'll add, though, my accountability comes from my investors right now. I think I mentioned earlier, I give the quarterly update. I spend a lot of time on it, and I treat it as though if I don't tell them everything they need to know, they're going to be mad at me. Hasn't really happened yet, but it's useful to believe that.
I have two questions. One is around this chicken and the egg issue that we're facing, where we've heard that investors, early stage investors, want to see a proof of concept and like a more finalized prototype, but we need to raise money in order to hire the people to finalize the prototype. So I've gotten some advice to like try to go to friends and family first who may be willing to invest in us before the prototype is finalized versus more kind of, I guess, experienced angel investors. But just curious to hear your thoughts on the chicken and the egg issue.
Yeah. Well, how much would the prototype cost? You can make up a number if you don't want to
say. Around 200,000, quite a bit of our own money. So another 200,000 is kind of beyond what we're able to do right now.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping you would say 20,000, in which case I would have said, anyone who's starting, like 20,000 is the least of your cost, right? You find find 20K. 200,000, I don't know. I mean, you could go back to that risk curve. And, you know, I wish I had a better answer. That's an attribute of a startup opportunity that may belong to people who have that comparative advantage of finding 200K really quickly. So, in a way, my answer is to ask, if that's not your comparative advantage, is there a different project you'd rather be working on? It's not a very inspiring response.
And then my second question is what your thoughts are on like the angel networks, like the Band of Angels or Life Science Angels, those types of like angel groups versus individual angel investors, if you have any thoughts on pros and cons of either.
Yeah. I haven't raised money from them. I think the pro is that just by virtue of being tapped into that network, you probably have access to other advice or other benefits, and even from the members of that network whose funds aren't part of your company. I'd say, though, in general, I'd prefer that my angels are people I know well. Again, I have one investor who I didn't know prior to his investment in our company. I've gotten to know him since. But especially in those early days where a lot of experiments don't go well, you kind of want people who have seen you deal with that before and believe that you're going to weather that. And it's not a criticism of those groups. It's just maybe a lack of an attribute I like, which is familiarity with those people.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com.
Hello. So you might have talked about this a little bit between why investors invest, whether it's impact versus returns. So we are a 3-year-old company. We have bootstrapped until now. We have one product that we're selling. We're in some number of hospitals. So we're not building another product. So that's why that's what we want to raise. That's what we want to fundraise for. And one response we got from one of the investors we talked to last week was, she said basically the numbers that we forecasted are pretty realistic in terms of what the companies that they invested are doing or where they're at right now, but they never pitched with those numbers in the first place.
They never what?
They never pitched with those numbers in the first place.
Okay.
So they were more ambitious. And I feel like because we've been bootstrapping for 3 years, we have pretty good, realistic set of numbers that we think we can hit. So would your opinion be that you just have to find those people who would believe in your track record? Or is it, you said you don't have to overhype it. You don't have, is that, I don't know what the typical approach here is.
I think the best thing you can do is come back in 3 months and say, look, we hit them. We hit those numbers. You're selling?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? This happens a lot at Rock Health. The advice I give to people who come in is I kind of take the approach of helping them put their best foot forward. And sometimes I'll talk to a company and they'll tell an exciting story. And I'll say, the best thing you can do is come back in 3 months and show me that you actually did that. And I'll remember that you told me, the point A when you show me point B. That's how you prove it. I think what you're describing is that they're just assuming that you've already multiplied by 2 to be impressive because that's what they've seen in the past. If you have the time, come back and prove that that's not what you're doing. Because almost no one is able to do that. Yeah, that's a good question. So his question was, if we're thinking through that framework of mitigating as much risk per dollar, per early dollar, per unit time, what tends to be the lower hanging fruit for doing that? I personally think IP. So I don't remember the name of the program, Fast Track or something, where you can file a patent and get a really quick review. To be able to have an issued patent or to know you're not going to get an issued patent, one of the dumbest things I think entrepreneurs do is try to prolong the IP review process. And sometimes they say, well, I don't want to get bad news while I'm fundraising. You want to get bad news as soon as you can so you can go do something more productive. So I think that's a really good cost-effective way of mitigating IP risk. It doesn't mean you're done with IP, but at least you kind of know, you start to know where you're at. I showed you earlier prototypes that that address safety, address efficacy, and look horrible. I feel like that's a theme. I've built many of those. Being really good at creating benchtop models. Let's take clinical risk. I spend a lot of time reading journal articles. And you'd be surprised that someone has done just about every experiment or something very close to it. And that won't fully mitigate your clinical risk. You'll start to see, well, if you do that, like paper published in 1984 and paper published in 1992, assuming those are sound science, then this thing is probably true. And I haven't done my clinical trial yet, and I will have to get regulatory clearance. But I might believe there's a 70% chance of this working instead of 40% because I've really mined the literature. So I would say, kind of ironically, clinical risk based on studies that others have done, IP risk based on that fast-track process, and then being really clever on benchtop benchtop models and prototype. I don't like market risk for a few reasons. It tends to come last in many cases. I have no reason to believe I'm especially good at it. And I don't think medical device startups are especially good at sales. If I'm a really good salesperson, I want to work for Johnson & Johnson and have a whole portfolio of stuff to just cram in. If I'm a really good engineer, I kind of want to work for a startup and build something new. So I think we, as startups, are artificially good at realizing technology and artificially bad at selling it. It's part of the reason why we get bought a lot, right? So for market risk, you know, there are other ways of assessing market risk other than launching your product. But you don't want, I don't like market risk.
Okay, question over here.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about sort of the maybe timelines that go between, you know, meeting an investor. Let's talk about like a venture capital round or venture sizable raise, from meeting them to actually fundraising from them, and whether there's like a time-based concern you have in your round that you're trying to raise. You know, it's been suggested maybe outside of MedTech primarily that there's sort of like this echo chamber effect that you kind of want to avoid and maybe try to raise money as quickly as possible. Not necessarily, you can kind of prolong the relationship building phase, but then at the point where you decide to start to fundraise, to try to do so, you know, relatively quickly.
My honest takeaway from my experience fundraising was that, you know, I just didn't, there were investors I was sure were out, and, you know, I contacted 6 months after the first conversation just to make sure they were really out. And they thought, oh, I thought I wired the money. So I think my big takeaway is like time travels, or time is sensed differently when you're the entrepreneur than when you're the investor. So I actually think the time variable, if you can use that to your advantage, if you can be flexible on that, you can use that to great advantage. It means that you know, philanthropic capital that isn't in a special hurry to be delivered, sometimes it's just a matter of allowing the right time to arrive. So, you know, in terms of signaling, I think for a venture capital firm, if they don't move fairly quickly, it's usually a bad sign. In terms of angels, my experience is just much more chaotic than I would have anticipated. It drives you nuts.
Thank you. In my deck, you know, as a VC, review my deck. Do you expect to see a lot of, you know, verbiage or thought around the financial model, the, you know, reimbursement and all that, especially if it's a market where, you know, there's no CPT codes and things like that?
Yeah. I like rigor. I like citations. I like a bibliography at the end. It means you didn't just Google it and tell me whatever. I think rigor is undervalued or underexploited by entrepreneurs pitching their companies. And VCs are famous for their low attention spans. There's a good chance they'll just kind of do a mental check. Okay, they're reading PDFs. But yes, absolutely.
And that counts for like how I'm going to make money type of like, you know, pricing models and things like that?
Yeah. And, you know, I think angels are going to be less rigorous or demand less rigor on that. But VCs, part of the reason, we just don't see it as much as you would think. You'd be surprised at how vague the majority of the slide decks we get are. If you haven't done that rig, if you haven't gone through that analysis, you probably shouldn't be starting the company. And if you've gone through that analysis, brag about it.
On that note, are there any particular maybe hilarious or annoying bad mistakes that you've seen in decks that you reviewed as an investor?
You know when you're being manipulated. I kind of have this question I ask, which is like, could this have been produced in a long weekend? Could the value being communicated here have come from nothing 3 days ago? The answer is yes in like 25% of the cases. Like, show me that you've done something that was hard to do.
Hey, so I'm not in the med space, so that might be a difference here. But we've had a hard time finding any angel investors or VCs, maybe because we don't have these friends. But we have gotten some offers of investment from potential customers. And so I was wondering why, you know, you didn't talk about that. And also those offers of investment, none of those people suggested something like a convertible note. They all, you know, made some offer for some percentage of the company.
Can I ask what space you're in?
Yeah, we make technology that will like change one person's voice into another that could be useful for like dubbing movies.
Okay. So I know nothing about that space. I'll probably give a really bad, useless answer. In medtech, we rarely have the luxury of customers investing because customers are kind of this long, this far off theoretical concept that we usually don't ever encounter. We get acquired first if we're lucky. It seems like a very good signal. If the people who buy your product, I know of cases where distributors for medical device companies have invested in the company. And I think that's a great signal that people who know what's going on the ground believe in the company. So that's an above average investor to boast of.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for saying that.